Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. After the Holocaust, the world said never again, but genocide and crimes against humanity continued through the 20th century and right up to the present, from Cambodia to Guatemala, Bosnia to Rwanda, millions murdered for their race, their creed, their tribe. The International Criminal Court, the ICC, was established in 2002 to bring crimes against humanity to light and to prosecute them. A new documentary looks at the struggle to give it force. This hour on Point, Warlords, War Crimes, and the International Criminal Court. You can join our conversation. Have you heard of the International Criminal Court? Do you think it can work? What do you want to know about the process of bringing war criminals to trial? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York City is Pamela Yates. She's director of the documentary film The Reckoning, The Battle for the International Criminal Court. It appeared at the 2009 Sundance Film Festival and has aired on PBS. You can watch the film online at pbs.org. Pamela Yates, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
Also joining us from New York is Christine Chung. She was the first senior trial attorney in the International Criminal Court's Office of the Prosecutor. She directed the investigation, which led to the first ICC arrest warrants for the leadership of Uganda's rebel Lord's Resistance Army, and she worked on the court's investigations in Darfur and in the Congo. She left the International Criminal Court in 2007 and is now writing a book about it. Christine Chung, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane.
Pamela Yates, let me begin with you. Help us understand right out of the gate here, what is the International Criminal Court?
The International Criminal Court is the first international court to try individuals for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. It was it's a treaty-based court. The treaty was written in 1998, and by 2002, 66 countries had ratified the Rome Statute, the treaty that created the court, and the court became operational. We wanted to make the film The Reckoning because we thought that this was such an exciting new idea. We weren't sure it was going to work. We weren't quite sure how it was going to operate, but we thought it would make a fascinating documentary. And it really did become a kind of political thriller about international crime and punishment in the end.
Indeed it did. As I watched it, I thought the same thing. What other courts and mechanisms for holding war criminals or for prosecuting them were in operation before the International Criminal Court existed?
Well, part of the reckoning is to try to get people to understand about the evolution of international justice from the Nuremberg tribunals through the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And those were ad hoc tribunals, temporary courts that tried individuals in a particular situation. But the international community really felt that it wasn't enough to have these ad hoc tribunals, that there really should be a permanent international criminal court that all the countries in the world could come together and try the worst perpetrators of these particular crimes. And that was the idea behind the International Criminal Court.
You mentioned 66 countries are member states of the International Criminal Court. Some countries were concerned initially that submitting to laws of international justice would limit their national sovereignty. Didn't that almost derail the formation of the ICC?
Absolutely. And the Rome Conference, which lasted 5 weeks, it was really a nail-biting down to the last moment. On the last day of the Rome Conference at 4 a.m. in the morning, and you see this really vividly in The Reckoning, they took a vote, and 120 countries voted for the Rome Statute. And there was a standing ovation that lasted 10 minutes. Veteran human rights defenders that I have talked to said it was the most exciting human rights moment in their entire life, that the international community could come together at this moment in time and create the Constitution for a new court.
Christine Chung, help us understand what kind of crimes the ICC takes on.
The court reserves itself for the worst crimes known to man, and so the jurisdiction of the court extends to genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. As a practical matter, the court obviously has limited resources and time, so that means that it strives to work in the worst situations that are occurring in the world. In the years that I was there, that meant that we got involved in northern Uganda, where there was a 20-year civil war going on between the Ugandan government and the Lord's Resistance Army, an armed rebel group. In the eastern Congo, where there's been a civil war going on that's killed more people directly or indirectly than any war since World War II. And in Darfur, which I think for your listeners, I don't have to explain very much about Darfur, but it gives you an idea of the gravity of the crimes and the types of crimes that the court was investigating and prosecuting.
This is a court of last resort, if you will. I mean, you prosecute cases that countries won't prosecute themselves, right? How big is the staff? How many prosecutors at ICC?
Well, when I went there, there was a staff of 40 in the Office of the Prosecutor. It was very much a justice startup. Now, and the court is much bigger than just the Office of the Prosecutor because you have the judges and you have all the administrative staff. So now I think the staff is about 600 or 700. It's become quite a robust international organization. It has very far-flung operations. We're talking about conducting investigations in the middle of war zones, which is something that really had not been done before, even at the ad hoc tribunals, because in those situations, typically you waited until the wars were over until you investigated the crimes. You're talking about a lot of translators, witness protection staff, new sets of judges and clerks. It was very exciting to be there at the time that this was all being built up, but in a quite short period of time, it's become highly operational.
You mentioned investigating in the middle of a war zone. Walk us through a case, if you would, Pamela and Christine. What do you do to build a case? Christine, you first.
Well, you know, I was a federal prosecutor in New York, and so I was always benchmarking against my domestic experience. And in one way, the crimes that you're investigating in these international settings are much more obvious. You know, when there's genocide going on or there's a war in which there are massacres of entire communities, part of you says, well, this should be easier to prove. But the logistics are incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. And another thing that's very hard and has proven to be true in the ad hoc tribunals is you really have to tie down the criminal liability of the top leaders. We're not really interested in mid-level leaders. We're not interested in low-level perpetrators.
Right.
So getting all the evidence to tie back to the very, very high perpetrators who are the ones who are legitimately your targets, that can be quite challenging. And so you meet witnesses at every level. You meet witnesses who are insiders in the organizations, who fought as maybe high-level soldiers, high-ranking soldiers. You meet with a lot of victims, which in a lot of ways was the most rewarding part of the job, is you meet people, ordinary people, whose lives have been upended, have lost family members, and they have never experienced justice before, and yet they have a great hope that if they give their accounts and the court can move forward, that justice will bring some measure of stability to their lives.
From a filmic perspective, I wanted to give the audience a sense of what it was like to be inside the office of the prosecutor as they investigated these crimes. But of course, it's a judicial process, so I can't be privy to everything that goes on. And I chose some emblematic cases that I thought might either were or might become International Criminal Court cases. So the film, The Reckoning, really jumps back and forth between what's being discovered in The Hague, what's happening on the ground, and what effect the International Criminal Court is having, even before it makes arrests or even before the first trial began.
I was so interested in the work that you did in Uganda, Pamela, and I actually have some sound from the film, The Reckoning, which I'd like to play here, because here in Uganda, the civil war spanning two decades forced well over a million people from their homes. This is from the film. Dennis Lemoyi was leader of the internally displaced person camp called PDAC. He has a question for the ICC prosecutor who secured the first ICC arrest warrants for the leadership of Uganda's rebel group, the Lord's Resistance Army. Here it is.
Luis Moreno Ocampo, I have heard him as being one of the specialists in the ICC If he was to come and meet me, I would ask him, the arrest warrant that the ICC has put in place, how can Luis Moreno get the top LRA commanders arrested? Do they have the capacity?
It's a good question, Christine Chung, because when you issue an arrest warrant, there's no police force to execute the arrests. I mean, who does it? Who makes the arrest?
Arrest is the responsibility in an international court system of the nations who belong to the court. So in this instance, you know, in my old job, when I wanted to arrest somebody, I handed an arrest warrant to the FBI or to the NYPD. In this job, what happens is the arrest warrant is issued by the judges, and then it goes out to the countries who belong to the court, and it becomes their responsibility to effectuate arrest. In the case of the Lord's Resistance Army, the arrest warrants were issued in 2005, and no one has yet been arrested. There were five defendants named, five leaders of the LRA. Although there have been military offensives and efforts to make the arrest. So it really goes back to the international community to figure out, well, how indeed do we apprehend the person? This is not a new issue in international justice. Milosevic is a famous example of somebody who escaped arrest for a long time.
Right.
But it has proven in the past to be a relentless process that often does end in arrest.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about bringing war criminals to justice in the International Criminal Court. Pamela Yates is with us. She's director of the new documentary film, The Reckoning, The Battle for the International Criminal Court. You can link to the full-length film at our website, onpointradio.org. Christine Chung is with us. Also, she was a senior trial attorney in the International Criminal Court's office of the prosecutor, has moved on to write a book about it. We have a lot of questions from our listeners, for both of you, Pamela and Christine. Let's go to one from Worcester, Massachusetts first. Charles is on the line. Charles, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say basically that I agree with the whole idea of the International Criminal Court. However, you know, leaving it up to the member countries to actually make the arrest doesn't really seem feasible, especially in, you know, countries like Africa, like Sudan and Uganda. Like, they're not really into arresting their own, especially, like, the president of Sudan, al-Bashir. I mean, they have an arrest warrant for him, but no one's really going to go after him. So, essentially, he's going to escape justice unless a foreign troop force can go in there and get him.
Mm-hmm. Charles, thank you. Christine, how do you figure out how to get countries to respect the ICC's authority? Do they, for the most part?
Well, you know, what I was surprised at when I was at the ICC is that having an international arrest warrant does change the dynamic. And one example I can give you of how countries do get together in new ways to find ways to bring accountability in the wake of an ICC arrest warrant is the Uganda case, because after the arrest warrant was issued, there were efforts by the Sudanese, the Ugandans, and the DRC armies to get together to mount joint operations against the Lord's Resistance Army. And that had never occurred before. And if you had told people who know that region very well 5 years before that these countries would be joining together to make an effort to fight the LRA, they would have said that it was impossible. Mm. Bashir is an interesting and obviously an opposite example where it seems impossible. He's the sitting head of state. He has been indicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Who will arrest Omar al-Bashir? Well, that's an incredibly difficult question. It's also a question that was asked about Slobodan Milosevic. But life has changed for Omar al-Bashir. There are countries that he cannot travel to anymore. He's made big efforts, great efforts, to avoid being in places where he might be arrested by member nations of the ICC. Other heads of state have refused to sit at the dinner table with him. So it's a long, slow process, but having the international attention and the international shaming is an effective tool, maybe not a very precise one or a fast one to use, but it's there.
Charles mentioned that Sudan case, as you've just been talking about. Here's some sound from it, from the film. This is an impassioned speech to the UN Security Council in June of 2008, when the International Criminal Court prosecutor Luis Moreno Campo asked the UN to help pressure the government of Sudan into executing the ICC's arrest warrants for state and militia leaders.
It takes a lot to commit massive crimes. It takes planning and organization. It takes commanders and many executioners. But mostly, it requires that the rest of the world look away and do nothing. Silence has never helped or protected victims. Silence, it only helps the criminals.
So, Pamela Yates, that arrest warrant was indeed fulfilled?
No, President al-Bashir of Sudan has not been arrested. But I think that what Luis Moreno Campo is trying to do, and he is a stellar presence in the reckoning, as is Christine Chung, what he's trying to do is he's trying to rally the support. He's trying to rally the international political will to sanction, to isolate, and to eventually arrest President al-Bashir. And he's a great film subject because he even goes into places like the United Nations, and he does not talk diplo speak as everyone else is doing there. He is just delivering the message straight, and he's calling on the nations of the world to rally around and isolate someone who has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity.
You talk about rallying political will, Pamela. I also got such a sense from the movie, watching it, that what the ICC does, it gives the powerless who have suffered terrible atrocities a real sense of hope, like someone is out there trying to bring justice. Is that part of what was so fulfilling for you working as a prosecutor at the ICC, Christine?
It was the single most fulfilling thing. I vividly remember one interview that we conducted in Uganda, and the entire time we were doing the interview was of a woman who had lost her child and had been the victim of an attack by the Lord's Resistance Army. And during the interview, we were very concerned as the interviewing team that she seemed very, very unhappy and on the verge of a breakdown the entire interview. And it is stressful for victims to recount what's happened to them. And so you worry that you are causing them to suffer trauma again by reliving what happened to them.
Right.
And at the end of the interview, the woman took us, shook our hands and embraced us and told us that it had been the happiest day of her life to speak to us because she never believed that anybody would come and listen to what she had to say. And this idea that people are coming from Europe, she doesn't really understand the court. She couldn't describe to you really anything about the first thing about the procedures of the court. But the idea that people are coming and they care and they're going to take her story to judges was incredible to her, and it made her weep with joy.
Here's another call from Manchester, Connecticut. Tony is on the line. Tony, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to an early question, unfortunately, I think the ICC is absolutely necessary because you and the rest of the world cannot depend on individual nations or states to police themselves. And I think the case in point, I believe that the United States withdrew from the ICC because there were questions about a massacre in Iraq. And my question would be, is there any possibility that the ICC would hold those people in the United States responsible for torture and the massacres and the illegal invasion to justice? Mm-hmm. Would there be any accounting in the ICC for the United States?
Tony, thanks. Let me ask first initially, what was U.S. involvement with the ICC when it was formed?
Well, the U.S. Participated in the negotiations at Rome under the Clinton administration, and in fact, the U.S. delegation was responsible for the shaping of the statute that created the court in many, many ways, including the definitions of the crimes. President Clinton never submitted the ICC statute, the treaty, for ratification to the Senate. So the status was that we had signed the treaty, but we had not ratified. And it takes two-thirds of the Senate to ratify any treaty, international treaty. The Bush administration unsigned the Rome Statute. So they decided right away that they were not going to support the ICC. And they took this step through John Bolton, then the ambassador to the UN, of unsigning the Rome Statute. This is an event that's covered in the movie, and John Bolton actually appears in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Since then, in the Bush administration, and the Bush administration, I should also say, was quite notoriously and openly hostile toward the court, including taking action to withhold funding from other countries who had joined the court and refused to sign agreements with the U.S. in which they promised that they would never turn over American nationals to the court if asked. Over time, the Bush administration realized that that strategy was not productive, that it was creating hardships between us and other countries when, in fact, we needed their cooperation for things like fighting terrorism. And the hostility drew back. And in the case of Darfur, when the UN Security Council was deciding whether or not to refer the Darfur situation to the ICC for investigation, the U.S. rather famously abstained from the vote, meaning that it allowed the Darfur situation to be referred to the ICC. Mm. And people who are court watchers and international relations watchers regarded that as quite a significant step forward in terms of U.S. relations with the court.
What about to Tony's question about the United States ever possibly being held responsible for activities in Iraq through the International Criminal Court?
Well, it couldn't really. The short answer is it couldn't happen. And it has to do with the jurisdiction rules of the court. Iraq is not a member of the court, and the U.S. is not a member of the court. So for the court to have jurisdiction, it has to be crimes occurring after 2002. It has to be citizens of or nationals of a country that belongs, or crimes that occurred on the territory of a country that belongs. The only exception is if the UN Security Council refers the situation to the court. That's what happened in Darfur. Sudan is not a member of the court, but it became the subject of an ICC investigation because the governing world body, the UN Security Council, decided that the case should be referred. So Iraq is beyond American officials, and what happened in Iraq is beyond the jurisdiction of the ICC.
You mentioned John Bolton. I just wanted to throw in some sound here from the film The Reckoning, because here he is before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1998, and he's talking about how the United States should approach the International Criminal Court.
Whether the ICC survives and flourishes depends in large measure on the United States. We should isolate and ignore the ICC. Tangible American interests are at risk. Our main concern should be for the president and other senior leaders responsible for our defense and foreign policy. Specifically, I propose for the U.S. policy the three no's: no financial support, directly or indirectly, no collaboration, and no further negotiations with other governments to improve the statute. This approach is likely to maximize the chances that the ICC will wither and collapse, which should be our objective.
Pamela Yates, is that still the U.S. position toward the ICC?
No, it's really interesting that the U.S. position has softened even during the last years of the Bush administration towards the ICC. And one of the reasons is because the ICC just went ahead and did what they had to do. They analyzed, they investigated, they issued arrest warrants. And I think there was a certain point where the Bush administration began to understand what the court was doing and that there were interests in common with the International Criminal Court. So that helped a great deal, especially in terms of the investigation into Darfur. Now with the Obama administration, they support the ICC's arrest warrant for the arrest of President al-Bashir.
But still hasn't joined the ICC officially.
No, well, that's a long process. First of all, we would have to reengage with the International Criminal Court. Hopefully, the United States will be at the review conference in 2010 in Uganda when all the countries that are signatories, all the states parties to the International Criminal Court will come together and look back and also plan for the future.
Let's go to Framingham, Massachusetts. Tendo is on the line. Tendo, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My question has to do with the Great Lakes region, where Uganda, Congo, and Sudan, and Kenya and Tanzania, where there's been a lot of turmoil over the last 30 or so years. Yet it seems like the ICC has, chosen to take just a few years beyond most of the atrocities that had occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, I don't know how far their jurisdiction goes, but does not address some of the deaths that occurred during the Idi Amin time. yet some of these people are moving freely within Uganda, those who were responsible for such atrocities. When I look at, you know, I went to Uganda, to school in Uganda, and when I look at all my classmates, I've probably lost 75% of my classmates due to violence. So I'm wondering whether the international, when they go to the review, that they will look back in the years of terrible atrocities in that region and those who perpetrated them who are still living freely.
Tendo, thank you. There's a Ugandan who's wondering if you'll ever broaden your scope, the ICC, and really try to bring everyone to justice. Seems like there's been some cherry-picking to his mind about who's prosecuted and who is not.
Well, it's again, what Tendo's describing is, again, it's an issue of the court's limited jurisdiction. The one thing that all the countries at Rome agreed on was that the court would only have jurisdiction over crimes that occurred after July 1, 2002, when the court came into effect. So nobody wanted to look backwards, and that's why crimes like those committed by Idi Amin and others of his ilk in that era will never be the subject of any court investigation. It's kind of a matter of the court had to start somewhere, and it started by looking forward.
And, you know, I think that the International Criminal Court is the fruit of all the injustice that was committed back during Idi Amin time and other dictators around the world who finished their lives in a golden exile in other countries. They committed these terrible atrocities, and yet they were able to live out their life with great power and great wealth. The International Criminal Court is saying this cannot happen, and this cannot happen from July 1st, 2002 forward. We're going to end this culture of impunity.
Pamela Yates, how did you craft the arc of the film, The Reckoning? I mean, you're telling it from the point of view of the International Criminal Court leadership itself, as opposed to the victims or the other countries. How did you choose to put the court front and center as the film's protagonist, if you will?
I chose it because it was an incredibly complicated story to tell. I mean, the film took 3 years to make. We filmed across 4 continents. It's in 6 languages. And how are we going to bring together this story into one coherent narrative that will engage the audience for an hour and a half? I didn't start out thinking that the court was going to be the protagonist in the film, but slowly I came to the realization that it was the only way to tell the story about this new court. And that's not to say that the victims don't have a huge voice in the reckoning. They really do, because one of the things that film does so well is to compress time and space so that the leader that you featured from the IDP camp, Dennis Lemoy, can actually speak to the International Criminal Court prosecutor. And that was the idea in the making of The Reckoning, that you would be in all these worlds and yet the audience would know exactly where they were and how the story was unfolding and how the reveals were being expressed to them in a surprising way.
Christine Chung, I'm curious, before we go to break here, what your personal reaction was, your personal response to the film as you watched it?
I do think it takes a very complicated subject matter and makes it incredibly compelling to watch. And you skip from time and place. We haven't talked at all about Colombia, which is another place where the movie is filmed. And on top of that, it's a very beautiful movie. I think that the footage and the cinematography is, especially of Africa, is just, you know, it's beautiful to watch. I've seen it with a lot of audiences, and I think what they like about the movie is that it presents a problem, and really an intractable one, of genocide and these horrible crimes. And we know from having lived through the generations that we're never going to be rid of these things. But it also presents a possible small beginning of a solution at the same time. And I think audiences find that quite uplifting.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking today about bringing war criminals to justice in the International Criminal Court. Pamela Yates is with us this hour. She directed the film, The Reckoning, a new PBS documentary about the International Criminal Court. And Christine Chung is also with me. She is a senior trial attorney in the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. I'd like to turn now to Congo, where the ICC has done some very important work And here's a clip from the movie, The Reckoning. It might sound cheerful, but this is a youth fight song for the Union of Patriotic Congolese Militia in Ituri, Congo, which speaks of beating 71 people one by one and of seeking revenge on ousted Ituri Governor Jean-Pierre Molondo Lopando. Christine Chung, tell me about the case in Congo. 4 million people have died there, the worst conflict since World War II. And this is not a binary conflict. I mean, there are mass atrocities carried out by several different groups. Is that right?
That's right. And with shifting allegiances over time, as an investigator and prosecutor, one of the huge challenges in an investigation like the Congo is just understanding the underlying facts. And trying to find a toehold of where you want to start bringing charges, because there's almost too many possibilities. And you need to find the case that can make a difference and the charges that can make a difference. It was always a big aim of ours to try to focus on top leaders and to promote deterrence, because, of course, the best situation is if the crimes don't occur in the first place. In the Congo, the court has had deterrent effects, I think, and the information is anecdotal, as it often is with deterrence. But you're talking about a place where there was absolute impunity. Warlords could commit crimes, governments can commit crimes, knowing with absolute certainty that no one is going to come after them. And so the fact that the court is on the scene has actually created some fear, some apprehension. Warlords who carry the Rome Statute around with them as they move from place to place. So it's an amazing dynamic. The first trial of the court involves Thomas Lubanga, who is the head of the UPC, whose soldiers were just singing the song on the segment that you played.
Here's more from the film. November 2006, the International Criminal Court brought its first war criminal to The Hague, and they charged Congolese militia leader Thomas Lubanga, as you just mentioned, with enlisting and conscripting child soldiers. Here's senior trial attorney for the prosecutor at the pretrial arraignment.
Thomas Lubanga Dilo made the children get military training. Thomas Lubanga Dilo made them train to kill. And Thomas Lubanga Dilo let them die in hostilities. Many, many children.
Pamela Yates, what was the significance of that trial?
Well, that trial is still going on. In fact, the trial actually began 2 days after we finished The Reckoning. And it will continue to go on. The prosecution has now rested its case. The defense will begin in September, and it's thought that there will be a verdict by the end of this year or the beginning of next year. But, you know, Jane, one of the things that we did with The Reckoning is that the film itself is actually an independent film that was broadcast on PBS. But we've also designed a 3-year outreach campaign, and the film is the flagship for this campaign. So we're keeping up. We're doing updates about the International Criminal Court, about the Lubanga trial, that you can see weekly summaries on ijcentral.org. You know, we're really taking a multimedia approach in the multimedia age. And we're taking a copyleft approach, which means that we're making all of these materials available free and online, including shorter video modules. If you want to show people about the creation of the International Criminal Court, it can be all found on the POV PBS site. Mm.
I'm just curious, back to Thomas Lubanga for a minute. Will the success of that prosecution, which is still underway, will it raise the expectation of what the ICC can do in the future?
I think the answer to that is it should. You know, you hope that if you have your first trial, and I think it's been a very compelling trial to watch. You can actually, it's live streamed every day. You can go to the ICC website and watch it. And yes, you're watching somebody who at a certain point in time in Eastern Congolese history was an incredibly powerful man who's been brought to justice. And now there are a line of people behind him. Jean-Pierre Bemba, who's accused of crimes committed in the Central African Republic. He's incredibly important. He was former vice president of the Congo Wealthy and politically connected family. His name is not a household name to Americans, but in Africa, he is a very, very prominent person. There's a rebel from the Darfur conflict who has submitted himself to the jurisdiction of the court, so his proceedings will move forward. And there are two other Congolese warlords who will face trial probably next year from groups that were opposed to the group of Thomas Lubanga. So the court is slowly, it's a slow process, but you hope that it is building up its track record and its credibility such that it can continue to expand the reach of its activities and its judgments.
Let's go back to the phones to Bluffton, South Carolina. Maria is waiting on the line. Maria, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yes, my question was, first of all, I want to say that I'm really happy that something like this exists. And my question was, how many criminals or how many warlords are being actually convicted before they're arrested and then they're convicted? How many have been convicted, and how, you know, has this been really making a big impact in these countries?
Maria, thank you. Christine?
Well, nobody's been convicted yet because Thomas Lubanga is the first trial. But I think the interesting part of the question is that, and one of the things that Pam's film shows very well, is the court has had impact even way before its first conviction. And it's a fascinating dynamic. But, for example, the segment about Colombia shows that countries and perpetrators are making efforts to bring accountability themselves so that they will never become subject to the court's jurisdiction. They want to avoid being the subject of an ICC prosecution or investigation. And so, and another thing is that countries who join the court are obligated to enact in their domestic laws the same standards, legal definitions of crimes that the Rome Statute contains. So the effects of the court are multifaceted, and it kind of sends tentacles out into domestic systems everywhere. The court obviously has to do its own cases, and it needs to have judgments, convictions, and sentencings, and it will. But one of the most interesting things about this court is that it can have deterrent effects and bring justice in forms that are other than just in its own courtroom.
Here's Lewis calling from Brewster, Massachusetts. Lewis, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello, thanks. Fascinating show. My question is, I understand the deterrent nature of these cases, looking at crimes and war crimes that have already happened in the past retroactively. And what I'm wondering, is there anything that's in place with this court to address ongoing genocides and war crimes as they're happening, to try to prevent them and nip them in the bud before they become, you know, the horrible things that they eventually do become?
Lewis, thank you. Christine Chung?
Yes. As I mentioned, in this court, we did start investigating in the midst of the conflict. So in Uganda, when we were on the ground, the war was still going on. And the same thing in Darfur. In fact, in Darfur, the conflict was so acute in 2005 when we began investigating that the prosecutor made the decision that we could not investigate within Darfur. It was going to be too dangerous for us and for the people that we were meeting, the witnesses and the victims we were meeting. So the effort on the part of the court has been to get involved and to show our presence even while the war is going on. The difficulty is you still need that international community support. And so when someone like Bashir is still out there, even though he's been indicted, you're sending a mixed message at best. The good news is that, you know, in my view, as someone who worked on the case, the truth has been told in terms of the need for this man to face accountability. The bad news is that the war continues because there's still not very strong or adequate support for carrying through the judgments of the court.
It just seems like it takes so long. One case takes a very long time, Pamela.
It certainly does, but justice moves very slowly, and I think it's important for the International Criminal Court to try these cases correctly, that there is full discovery on both the part of the prosecution and defense, and that the alleged perpetrator is given a fair trial. And those things just take time. But it's important that the court does it right so that it's seen as a legitimate court, which it is.
Here's Scott in Savannah, Georgia. Welcome to the program, Scott. Hello.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Hi. Good.
I just wanted to bring to the table, with an organization as big as the ICC seems to be getting, why would they stop their legislation at the point of passing the subpoenas over to the countries themselves and not have an actual task force that goes in and implements these, you know, these subpoenas and brings the people who are responsible in by themselves, and not using valuable resources that countries that are in the situations that they're in can't afford to waste.
Mm. Scott, thank you. What about some kind of backup force to go in and back up the ICC in these countries, forcibly take people if necessary? Christine?
Yeah, I just don't think that's politically feasible. I mean, you're talking about some kind of international army, and, you know, we're just not at the phase. And it's not a decision of the ICC. The ICC might like that, but the problem is that the countries who created the ICC weren't ready to take that step to have some kind of international it's more than Interpol. You're talking about something that would be invasive. And the other thing that I realized when I worked at the ICC is, although that sounds very appealing, in every situation there's sort of a different coalition of the willing, if you will. I mean, there's always going to be countries who have interests in effecting arrest in any given situation, but it's not always going to be the same group of countries. So, you know, maybe someday countries will reach the point where they're willing to say, we want an international court and we want to give that international court an international police force. We haven't gotten to that stage in the development of global governance yet.
Here's Hassan. He's in Boston, Massachusetts. Hassan, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm just wondering, you know, most of the arrest warrant against African leaders. I mean, we all saw what happened on the Gaza Strip earlier this year. Are they going to brought Olmert or also?
I think, if I understand correctly, you say that ICC seems to be focusing narrowly on people in Africa, most specifically. Pamela, is that true? We've talked a little bit about those African cases today.
Well, the first cases are certainly coming from Africa, but three of those four cases were referred by the African countries themselves, and the fourth one, Sudan, was a referral from the UN Security Council. There are 30 countries who are states parties of the International Criminal Court who are African countries, actually the most from any continent, who are members of the International Criminal Court are from Africa. So it really is also an African court, and it's a signaling that Africans as well don't want these crimes to go unpunished. I know that the International Criminal Court also has preliminary analysis open in Colombia, which you see in the reckoning, and in Kenya, in Georgia. So there are other places that the prosecutor is looking at. But remember, these are the first years of the International Criminal Court.
Is it right for the ICC to get involved in places like, for example, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, what's happened there, and I think your caller was referring to it, is that the Palestine Authority has invoked a part of the Rome Statute that allows even non-members of the court to come to the court and say, we cede jurisdiction to the court, in effect. We'd like you to come and investigate. And so the Palestinian Authority has asked for the court to consider opening an investigation into crimes committed on the Palestinian territory. And so your caller was saying, well, what's going to happen with Olmert? You know, is this going to be a two-sided investigation? Now, there's been no decision by the ICC to open an investigation into either Palestine or Israeli conduct. And in fact, it poses a thorny threshold question because you would have to regard the Palestinian Authority as a state, which is a step that that no international, certainly not the UN Security Council, has been willing to take. So there's a question of whether you recognize the Palestine Authority as a state, just under the ICC statute. And then if you did reach the stage where an investigation opened, certainly the precedent of the ICC has been to investigate all sides of the conflict equally. It doesn't remove jurisdictional barriers. You still have the problem that Israelis would ordinarily not be subject to the court's jurisdiction because they are not members. Israel is not a member of the court. So it kind of shows, of course, when people hear the Middle East, they think, oh, that's how could the court get involved there? That would be so difficult. There are so many problems. But I think what the caller's, what the call shows is when you present the idea of the ICC, people begin applying the idea in different conflicts, and that's probably a healthy thing. You're talking about applying the same rule of law in all conflicts, and there's reasons why there won't be even application right at the beginning, including who's joined and who hasn't joined. But I actually find it very encouraging that people start thinking, okay, have war crimes occurred in these places? What can be done about it? How could they potentially be reached?
In our final 30 seconds here, Pamela Yates, I'll give you the last word. What's the biggest challenge, the biggest stumbling block to the ICC moving forward, do you think?
I think making the arrests. And, you know, as citizens of the international community, we have to make sure that these arrests can be effected through whatever political activity we have in our own countries.
Pamela Yates is director of The Reckoning, the battle for the International Criminal Court. Pamela, it's a very powerful film. I appreciate you making it. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Jane.
Christine Chung was senior trial attorney at the International Criminal Court's Office of the Prosecutor. She is now writing a book on the International Criminal Court. Christine, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
You can watch the full-length film, Get the On Point podcast, at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.